Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us at this hour, Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It's Monday, May 11th. We get the latest on efforts to help families and businesses in Chuuk, where Super Typhoon Sinlaku devastated an island community. Recovery is complicated as residents don't qualify for some federal aid. The state legislative session is concluded. How well did lawmakers do? And will he or won't we? What will the governor veto or sign into law? We survey what's to see in the night sky this month and clue you in on cutting-edge research into comets and asteroids. We look at pushback over AI-generated music now playing at our airports, what local musicians want you to know. And Shipment Day, One Woman's Exile, a stage production sees its broadcast premiere on PBS Hawaii. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a month since Super Typhoon Sinlaku sat and pummeled islands in the Western Pacific. The Northern Marianas and Federated States of Micronesia were hardest hit. The slow-moving superstorm battered the tiny islands, and it could be months before electricity is fully restored. This morning, we hear about recovery efforts in Chuuk. Here with us this morning is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what can you tell us?
So recovery efforts have been very slow. We saw that Typhoon Sinlaku not only hit the Mariana Islands, but also Chuuk, which is located in the Federated States of Micronesia and is part of the COFA Nations, which is the Compact of Free Association. And those are those treaties that these island nations share with the United States. But Typhoon Sinlaku in Chuuk actually hit on April 10. And all those sustaining winds hit up to 185 miles per hour. It uprooted crops like breadfruit trees. It even tore through tin roofs. And even most of the homes are made of concrete, which is supposed to be typhoon proof. And you would think that, yeah. But because the winds were so strong, it uprooted a lot of these coconut and breadfruit trees to topple on top of their homes and even cracked ceilings, for example. So that was very devastating. It even also capsized a bunch of smaller boats that were used to help with those relief efforts. And that was a separate issue that a government official told me that because of those sunken boats, it was leaking oil into the water. So that's another issue that they're dealing with. And you look at the death toll, 17 has been reported so far in both Chuuk and the Mariana Islands.
Yeah, that's startling because usually there aren't any casualties or very few. And so 17 is huge. I know there was that cargo ship that overturned and six of the mariners perished in that. But yeah, it's crazy.
No, it's very devastating. And, you know, these are low-lying atolls in the Federated States of Micronesia. I mean, power has been slowly restoring to some of the areas, but we're looking at the most remote parts of the outer islands of Chuuk. And even though typhoons are nothing new into the western parts of the Pacific Ocean, some Chuuk residents have told me they felt caught off guard. One Chuuk resident I spoke to talked about the lack of preparedness. Here's Lahaina Phillip.
There really hasn't been any coverage on Typhoon Sinlaku here in Chuuk, but the impact here is devastating. The typhoon was something that majority of us didn't prepare for, which is why we didn't anticipate how much damage it would cause. Mainly because the initial announcement was that it was just going to be a tropical storm. So many of us didn't stock up on food or supplies beforehand. So many people did not tie down their houses or board up, you know. So it was just like a really unclear message or even the lack thereof beforehand. So when the typhoon came, it stayed for a while. Like, it stayed with us for 4 days. And many of us were just stuck at home 4 days. And with the roads being blocked and damaged, so many people were freaking out that they were going to go hungry and they were going to be helpless in their homes. But you know what? Yes, our houses were damaged and all. But as a community, our biggest loss is losing all our food staples that we, as Chukis, as a people, we highly depend on. One thing about us Chukis is that we may have modernized and adopted a modern diet, but we still rely heavily on our local foods. So losing all our breadfruit trees, mango trees, bananas, taros, or even our coconuts, that has been the most heartbreaking part of it all.
And, you know, I understand what she's saying about initially they just heard it was going to be a tropical storm because mm-hmm. a friend of mine had said, hey, there's a storm heading out, you know, your way. And I thought, well, we don't, you know, get serious until we know it's going to be a super typhoon. Tropical storms, you know, they're a dime a dozen, right? But then to have this become a super typhoon so quickly, and then once it got into the area, it just sat and moved so slowly. Oh, it's just awful.
And residents have told me it's really scary when you think of specifically for Chuuk, 185 miles per hour. I asked a resident, you know, what would that actually feel like being in that type of wind going that fast? They've told me, imagine you're sitting on an airplane, but you don't have the walls to protect you from those lashing winds. That's how fast the winds have been moving. And you look at the recovery efforts, some residents say it's still slow, but some of the government officials from Chuuk said, you know, they're right on schedule, but it is taking a lot of more resources than anticipated to get food and water to the most outer part of the islands. And when we talk about the Federal Emergency Management Agency that is going to the Mariana Islands because of U.S. territories, because of the new compact agreement that was signed in 2024, FSM doesn't get any FEMA aid. It's only for Micronesians in the U.S. states and its territories. The Federated States of Micronesia and Chuuk have to rely on the United Nations to get like that type of relief. And even the Chuuk governor and the Federated States of Micronesia president have issued an emergency declaration on April 14. But they're still there's still kind of like the recovery efforts going on that residents are worried about. But, you know, it took me 2 weeks to get a hold of someone from the Chuuk government to tell me what's going on. We had to do an interview through WhatsApp on voice memo. I know you were telling me that you had some trouble getting a hold of officials to tell you what's going on.
Right, with the military, because they're working out there. But the communications are spotty.
Exactly. Hardly any Wi-Fi. Power's still out. But I did get a hold of Brian Morey, who is a special advisor to the governor on social affairs in Chuuk, and he said a lot of work still needs to be done.
Reconstruction hasn't even started yet. We're still in kind of recovery mode, relief. We're still bringing it out, but a lot of work needs to be done. We have a lot of challenges, most especially with our ports, our sunken vessels that are leaking oil. We're still trying to address that. And, you know, most especially, getting relief out to our citizens or our communities. It's still very difficult with the shortage of food availability in the stores. We've lost all breadfruit trees, all taro in the taro patches. So having those as our main source of starch, we're very heavily reliant on rice and rice stock. You know, none of the stores really were ready for the typhoon. So, we're exhausting resources in food and water.
And I imagine, too, the residents here in Hawaii, the Micronesian community, are doing what they can to help.
They can. They're trying. Right now, a lot of people are just relying on GoFundMe accounts to send to their families. When I spoke to Josie Howard, who is the CEO and president of We Are Oceania, she said the biggest need that Chuuk residents need right now is food, water, and also chainsaws. There is actually a lot of residents who were chopping down the trees that were blocking the roads by hand, by axe. So that's what they need the most help on. But we're looking at the total cost. the total damages that's done to Chuuk. Brian Mori told me that he estimates $96 million alone for homes and crops is estimated in total damage. What's harder to get those resources out there is the Outer Islands is because they're going to be in El Nino, which means like it's going to be rougher seas. And then he's also worried about the drought season is coming. So if those residents without clean water can't get access to it, that's what he's most worried about is the drought season.
Yeah, no, it's crazy because everything's off kilter and the hurricane season here could start sooner, mm-hmm. and everything's all kapakai. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from Cassie Ordonio. You look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Tune in to HPR 2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Dane Lam, performs Beethoven's 5th and 8th symphonies. We'll also hear Old Bay, an original work by composer Raymond Yu. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR2, your home for classical music. Sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Some 250 bills are headed up to the governor's office for his signature to become law or to veto. This morning, we hear from Star Appetizer's political reporter Dan Nicasso about the next steps. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you and Andrew Gomes put together pretty comprehensive coverage in the paper about what passed and what didn't.
Yeah, appreciate you saying that. Well, the one that affects the major piece of legislation that affects everybody that pays taxes is the continuation of the historic tax breaks that Governor Green initially wanted to stall because of concerns over the budget when the session began. And as you all know, the ledge preserved them. And notably in an election year, which would have been created a lot of problems for legislators, and as well as the green fee taxes that have already been being accrued, how they're going to be spent. There was some little controversy there, but in general, what's probably more notable is some of the major bills that died, notably the efforts to quote unquote unmask ICE agents doing immigration enforcement. There were several bills, and they all died after the Ninth Circuit Court overturned California's law that would done essentially the same thing. And of course, Hawaii's part of the Ninth Circuit, so the legislators saw that as a non-starter. They did curtail county and state law enforcement from participating in federal immigration enforcement, as well as several of the bills that would ensure rights for those who are detained by ICE.
Yeah, but on the tax front, was surprising to see some of the tax bills that failed. Right, there was always that perennial bill to cut the excise tax on food and prescription
medication.
Drugs. Yeah.
No, they. That's right. The DET on food and prescription drugs has come up repeatedly, and it's always died. And they also shut down things like universal free meals in public schools at a time when everybody's struggling financially, as well as the cell phone ban in public schools. That went down. They did, as well as a bill that attempted to eliminate prediction markets, which are in the news now for the special forces soldier that was being questioned over his profiting off the Iran war. We've also got the cruise ship tax bill went down, and while the that was in response to the cruise ship industry's court challenge to the imposition of the green fee on cruise ships for the first time, and several others. As well as the bill that's been kicking around since Green came into office that would make Hawaii's drunk driving standard be as low as 0.05 to be guilty of drunken driving, which essentially is one drink, if that. Mm. And that would make it similar to Utah as having that standard. That got rejected as well.
Yeah, well, you know, of the bills that the governor is going to get up to his desk, any sense as to what he's going to do as far as vetoes?
No, not yet. He's got until mid-July to do that, and before then, of course, he unveils his intent to veto list. There were several bills that did pass that had stalled last year that would aimed at so-called clean government in response to the Sylvia Luke target letter that she received. Suddenly that had renewed steam. But one of the bills that did pass would limit the ability of members of the executive branch to perform duties that might influence how they operate. And that'll be interesting to see if he passes that,
right,
or if he signs it.
Well, like I said, you have mapped out, a pretty comprehensive list of what failed and what passed. And so, yeah, if our listeners want to go back and look at that, that's been super helpful. But thank you so much, Dan.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Dan Nicasso. You can read his coverage at staradvertiser.com. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. It's been a month since a national chain opened its largest restaurant to date in Hawaii. The Chick-fil-A at Kapi'olani and Kalakaua in Honolulu seats up to 260 people and brings approximately 120 jobs to the city. But did you know the fast food joint has another Hawaii connection? S. Truett County founded Chick-fil-A in Atlanta in 1967 and led the company for nearly 50 years. And in that time, he created a chicken empire. He grew the brand to thousands of franchise locations and sales of more than $20 billion. After a trip to Hawaii in 2013, he retired, and his son Dan took over the company. But that trip to the islands also inspired S. Truett County to start a new restaurant under the brand. This joint is located in Georgia and claims to bring the spirit of Hawaii to the Peach State. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of the Hawaii-inspired restaurant started by the founder of Chick-fil-A? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NāreitHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Will Sharp. He was nominated for an Emmy for his portrayal of Ethan, a tech entrepreneur in Season 2 of White Lotus. He's also starred in the TV show Too Much and the film A Real Pain. Now, he stars as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in a new adaptation of Amadeus. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
A Blue Micromoon, Visits to Telescopes and Decoding Comets. It's our monthly feature of sights to see in the beautiful skies above Hawaii. Some exciting discoveries made by local astronomers and free public events for the astronomically curious. Roy Gal is an astronomer and outreach coordinator at the University of Hawaii Institute for Astronomy. He spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender for Hawaii Skies.
So last month we talked about humans orbiting the moon in the Artemis II mission, but I hear there's some neat lunar viewing this month. What's interesting about May's moon?
Well, May actually has two moons. We had a full moon on the 1st, and we're going to cap off the month on the 31st with a micro blue moon. So micro means small, and this is going to be the smallest appearing full moon of the year. We're going to catch this full moon right when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth, which we call apogee. Right around when it's turning full, so we call it a micro moon. And because it's the second full moon in the month, the term for that is a blue moon. It's going to look about 14% smaller than a supermoon. That's when the moon is really close to Earth. So that's like the difference between someone who's 6 feet tall versus someone who's 7 feet tall. So it's pretty noticeable.
Wow. Okay, so we're bringing new meaning to the phrase once in a blue moon.
That's exactly where it comes from.
Any other good sights this month?
Well, the summer is the prime time for us to see our home galaxy, the Milky Way, overhead, and we're on our way into that. So before midnight, you can start to see the galaxy rising above the horizon. And we'll have a new moon in the middle of the month, and so with those darker skies, it'll really give you a chance to see the beautiful Milky Way overhead. Also in the middle of the month, on May 18th, we're going to get a beautiful thin crescent moon and Venus together on the western horizon, just a little bit after sunset.
That sounds really pretty. What about research that's ongoing?
Well, you may know that the University of Hawaii's Pan-STARRS and Atlas telescopes are some of the world leaders in finding comets and asteroids. And one of those, Comet 3I Atlas, is a visitor from another solar system. And we've been studying that, as have been other astronomers. And so a team from Japan, using the Subaru telescope on Mauna Kea, observed this comet back in January, just after it made its closest approach to the sun. And what they were doing was looking at the colors of the fuzzy coma of the comet. And those colors actually encode somewhat the ratio of carbon dioxide and water. And what they saw was that that ratio changed from before it passed near the sun to after, as more of the internal parts of the comet get exposed. So that gives us clues to what's inside this comet from another solar system. And then we can compare it to our comets and see if other solar systems and ours are similar.
I love the descriptor fuzzy around this comet. It makes me want to give it a hug. So after the winter, now that we're coming out of those winter months, a free set of monthly tours are reopening on Mauna Kea. Can you tell us more about that?
That's right. So the Mauna Kea Observatories run something called the Kama'aina Observatory Experience, which is only for Hawaii residents. You'll need your Hawaii ID. And it gives you the opportunity to visit the telescopes on the summit of Mauna Kea and actually go inside and see how they operate. So, and you learn about the science, the culture, the environmental importance of the Mauna. And we provide the transportation from the visitor information station up to the observatories and back down. And you'll even get lunch at the place where the astronomers stay, Hale Pohaku. There's space for 28 people, 14 people to each of two observatories. And registration opens a month ahead of each tour date. And you got to be at least age 13 to go. Ages 13 to 17 need a parent with them. You better be ready to get up early because you'll have to be up at the visitor information station, which is at 9,000 feet elevation, by 8 a.m. in the morning. And you'll be back down and done with lunch around 1:30 in the afternoon.
Well, it seems like a great way to see the stars and to see the snow on top of the mountain, too.
If there's any left.
Thanks so much, Roy.
Thank you.
That was UH astronomer Roy Gal and HPR's Maddie Bender. Look for links to find out more on our website later today.
Coasting on a road, a road that leads to nowhere, trying to find a place to stay.
Visitors to the Honolulu International Airport may have noticed music playing at the top of the hour that you might not be familiar with. Well, the Department of Transportation says that the 17 songs were generated by artificial intelligence. And while the DOT says there are no state funds were used to produce the songs, local musicians have not been thrilled about the use of AI music. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Roger Bong, owner of the record shop. And if his name sounds familiar, Bong was a host of Mauka to Makai on HPR. His label, Aloha Got Soul, released a compilation called Music for the Airport, a not-so-subtle response to the headlines.
When I read the news that Honolulu's airport is using AI music, I think a lot of people, I got pretty upset. And my mind started working. What can we do? What can we do? At Aloha Got Soul, there's so much music and so many artists that we work with across generations, across all different genres. I wanted to do something as a response. So I think I heard the news on Monday, and then by Friday I had a 17-track compilation to put out. 17 songs is the amount of songs that the Honolulu Airport is apparently using. But I say it came together in 4 days, but actually it's taken like 6+ years. Some of these artists on the compilation, like I've met them before the pandemic, licensed music from them before the pandemic, and they and I have been patiently waiting for the right time to represent their music to the world. So like Joni Komatsu is a great example. I've known her for quite a long time. Keoki Cortez from Cool Elevation. We haven't actually met in person, but we've chatted on the phone and over email. We're going to reissue his CD at some point. But yeah, like a lot of these artists on this compilation, Aloha Got Soul has worked with in some capacity, but hasn't yet re-released their music publicly. So this felt like a really good opportunity to do that.
Talk more about that initial feeling when you heard that news, whether it was surprise or frustration.
I mean, my first reaction was not something you could put on the air, probably. But I think my second thought was that, what if the airport starts putting up images created by AI of Diamond Head or Waikiki Beach or Haleakala or these famous sites? If they were to say, hey, we need to fill this wall with a poster of something from Hawaii, are they going to go and find a photographer or maybe like an illustrator to create some? They have some beautiful art at the airport. But what if you walked in, whether you're living here or you're a visitor, and the first thing you see is an AI image of Hawaii? It kind of, how do I say, misses the point. And I think I was just shaking my head, like, why would they? I can assume that why they did something like this. AI is a cost-saving measure. It's much cheaper than hiring musicians to write original songs. You can just type some prompts in and out comes a result. But when it comes to something like music, art, those things need to have like process behind them. They need to have the blood, sweat, and tears. They need to have the sacrifice, the struggle, but also like the heart and the soul going into it for it to be, for the result to be something worth enjoying or listening to or looking at, right? And so I think resorting to AI here just really missed the point. And I'll also say one other thing, like this other thought came to me after the fact that the release came out on Friday. I had some time to kind of like let it settle. Airports in the world don't necessarily need music to begin with. It's already a pretty hectic place. Like you don't need to be listening to some pop music. It might stress you out some more. And there's a great album from 1978, Brian Eno's Music for Airports. And it's a very like environmental ambient, very calming album to listen to. And he created that because he had kind of a very similar realization that we don't need to be listening to like pop music in the background while we're at the airport. The airport's not a theme park. It's not a shopping mall. It's a kind of non-place where we're going in between one to the next. And we don't need this extra element. But it being Hawaii, it makes sense to have that extra element because music is so strong and rooted in the culture here.
It seems like what you keep coming back to is the deliberate intention that musicians put into their work. And then also from your vantage point as someone who selects music and figures out what order to put it in and how to package and repackage and re-release, that there you put a lot of thought into that job.
As a selector, as you said, I'm a DJ, I'm a radio show host. I produce releases like this compilation, or we did one called For Our Friends, another one called Mixplate. There's so much music that's being made today. There was so much music that has been made in the past. And so many of these songs that are created are representations of an artist's dreams, their hopes, their artistic expression, something that they have inside of them that they need to get out. And that's really important that that happens. I think it's also really important that someone, whether they're like a curator, selector, or I don't know what you want to call it, but someone is able to like take the time to understand what the message is and find ways to direct it to an audience or listenership who will then understand it. And I think these 17 artists, I mean, if you look at the track list, I would say Mackie Fury is the most popular or well-known, Steven Teresa, Teresa Bright, Steve Ma'i'i. But then you have a lot of other artists who might not be as well known. There's Aaron Araneta, who passed away in November last year. Carrie Nichol. There's a great group called Pa Hoi Hoi, which Charles Ricardo was in with another artist. And there's just so much music that's come out of Hawaii. And the first song, really, Oceanside Band, a guy named Wendell Rosa, who fronts the band. Yeah, I mean, we put that song first because it just hits you right away. It's so good. And everyone who's listened to this compilation is like, oh my God, what is this song? Oceanside Band? Wind and Sea? What is this? You know, so to kind of tie it up, like there's just so much music. But that being said, like we should pull from that pool, especially for something like the Honolulu Airport, which has 21 million visitors a year, according to their website. I will also say, just for the record, almost none of these artists knew that this compilation was happening until we announced the release. One artist I reached out to was Kainani Kahau Naele, because we hadn't actually licensed that song for this purpose, so we had to clear that. But yeah, none of the artists knew that this was I didn't even know this was coming. But it's something when you trust your gut like that and something happens and it feels right, you kind of have to just run with it.
Well, how have they felt about being on this compilation that is pretty unsubtly referencing this headline in the news about AI-generated music?
Yeah, I think a lot of artists are happy. And some of these artists, their careers, you know, they're not necessarily playing music as a profession anymore, or they recorded these songs a few decades ago. And so this stuff is like oldies but goodies to them. I think there's a lot of gratitude and a lot of excitement and curiosity for the potential of how far this idea, this project is going to reach. Maybe they'll play some of these songs in the airport. That would be the most ideal outcome of this. It's not actually what I, you know, the name of the compilation is Music for the Airport, but it wasn't my intention to kind of like elbow our way in. It was just, you know, if you're a traveler or you're coming home and you want to listen to something that's not currently playing over the speakers, and you're like, what, this could be the alternative soundtrack to that, to what's currently there.
I did want to end on kind of a big picture zoom out note here. Are we taking spots away from musicians in the local music scene when we rely on AI generated music and media? Like, thinking about Hawaii specifically and how much talent there is, and relatively speaking, how few opportunities there are, what does AI music add to the mix or subtract from it?
That's a really good question. And I think it's one that everyone's navigating currently. Simply put, yes, this does take away slots from local artists. When there's not a lot of opportunities, like you said, I think that if you are a performing artist in Hawaii, a lot of your gigs are going to be at hotels or weddings or bars. There's only so many concert venues, right? Independent music venues to play. The industry is pretty small on the islands. I think what ends up happening is a lot of Hawaii artists realize they need to look to the outside to find greater success. But I think a place like, I think they shot themselves in the foot, to say it bluntly, but kind of nicely, I guess, when they decided to use AI-generated music at the airport. I mean, 20 plus million travelers going through. That's more than any hotel on the island will see. It's kind of like, can we just please try a little harder sometimes, you know? Like, I don't want to come off the wrong way, but like, they think they kind of shot themselves in the foot there. The airport is, for 99% of people coming to Hawaii, the first place you're going to be. And that's the best opportunity to introduce people to things like ocean safety, or, you know, you have the racks of brochures with all the travel info. You have the beautiful art on the walls, and you have the music. And if the music is, you know, like AI music alongside some legends like Genoa Keawe or Israel Kamakaviva Ole, there's a lot of artists in Hawaii who just haven't made it that big. They haven't cemented their legacy like those artists have. And I think in some ways it says, hey, if you're not good enough to be at that level, you might want to just stop trying. And that's not what artists need to hear, especially when the industry is so pretty small. There's only so many avenues or outlets that artists can. I mean, in this, I'll say also, though, in this day and age, like with the internet, social media, an artist in Hawaii can build and reach and build an audience around the world, not in Hawaii. I mean, they can have fans everywhere else except in the islands. So that's a huge plus. But the local industry needs to continue to be supported by local institutions. And the only way that an artist like these great legends got to where they were is because they had the support. And so we need to keep that going. So that's what I wanted to say. Yeah.
I appreciate you taking the time today, Roger. Thank you.
Thank you, Maddie.
That was Roger Bong of Aloha Got Soul and HPR's Maddie Bender. They spoke about Music for the Airport, a 17-song compilation released in response to the news that the Honolulu International Airport is playing AI-generated music at the top of the hour from 5 a.m. to midnight. The Department of Transportation said in a statement that in addition to the free AI music, the state is paying about $10,000 annually for a music track featuring songs by local artists, and Hawaii airports also feature live Hawaiian music funded by the Hawaii Tourism Authority.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
It is getting harder and harder to make ends meet in this economy, so people are doing what a lot of people do when that happens.
My husband, he told me, go to school. Don't just be at home. Don't wait for anybody to do things for you. You fight for yourself.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the economics of adult education, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than 3 decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
Now it's time to hatch and season the answer to today's quiz. Earlier, we refreshed your memory about the fast food chain Chick-fil-A, and if lines down South Baratania Street in Honolulu are in any indicator, the chain is a local favorite. The largest Chick-fil-A restaurant opened in Hawaii at the corner of Kapi'olani and Kalakaua. That mauka parcel has an interesting history. It was home to the Kaukau Corner from 1935 until 1960. Then Coco's Coffee House took over the space, committing to being open 24/7, just like its predecessor. Until the 90s, the Hard Rock Cafe called the spot home. And earlier we told you about a fateful trip to Hawaii taken by Chick-fil-A founder S. Truett Cathy in 2013. Afterwards, he decided to retire and hand leadership over to his son. But before he did, he opened the only Hawaii-themed restaurant in the Chick-fil-A brand portfolio. We asked you for the name of this Georgia joint. We were looking for Truett's Luau. And we have no winners today. We stumped you on that one. So that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Shipment Day is a poignant story of one woman's exile to a remote settlement for those who had the misfortune of being diagnosed with leprosy or Hansen's disease. We first highlighted Olivia Ribello-Bretta's life when the stage production hit Manoa Valley Theater to help celebrate its 20th anniversary. We talked to writer-director Lorenzo Di Stefano, who learned the plight of a relative and felt compelled to share it. Well, that play is now a film and will broadcast later this month on PBS Hawaii. Here's a snippet of a conversation between Olivia and her father just before Shipment Day to Kalopapa.
I should have come to see you in the hospital. I was wrong not to. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm here now. And that's what matters. How come you're not at work?
And laid me off again.
Again? What for?
So the hospital let you out? Oh, let me guess. You let yourself out. Yeah. They can't keep a real Portuguese locked up for long.
I got a letter.
From who?
The Board of Health.
And?
They're sending me away.
When?
Tomorrow.
Where?
Yes, Papa. Over there.
Share with our listeners how this came to be a film. Because when we chatted, you were getting it together for production at the Manoa Valley Theater.
Yes. This is the filmed version of that production. So it's not a film in the sense it's not a feature film adapted from the play. It's the play adapted into a fully produced video. So we filmed a couple of live performances at Manoa Valley Theater. And then we also did a shoot separate without an audience so we could get closer shots, and the cast all came together. So this then was edited together. And this version that PBS Hawaii will be presenting is a new version in the sense it has an all-new soundtrack with original music by a lot of wonderful musicians in Hawaii. and some lovely archival music courtesy of the Hawaii State Archives, or some older Hawaiian stuff. So it's a new mix, a much better soundtrack actually than we had before, but it's the same story of Olivia's childhood and her learning at 18 that she was diagnosed with Hansen's disease and then being arrested, literally, and taken to Kalihi Hospital for 2.5 years and then sent to Kalapapa in 1937, where she stayed until she was 90, where she died. This is the 20th anniversary of her death. September 28th of this year will be 20 years. So we're in the 20th year of her passing, yes.
And so what was it like for you when you found out about her story and why you felt so passionate to bring it on stage and on screen?
Well, you know, she and my mom were first cousins. Their mothers were sisters. These are Portuguese girls from Kauai. And I hadn't heard about Olivia, and I saw a copy of her book, which is still out there. It's called My Life of Exile in Kalapapa. And I said to my mom, "Who's this?" And she said, "That's our cousin." So I met her in 1989 and knew her for 17 years between 89 and 2006 when she died. I found her tremendous, you know, to know there was a person in the family who was that courageous and that strong and also a writer, as I was a writer myself, was a revelation. And her story is pretty unique. I call her the Rosa Parks of leprosy, in the sense she was like Rosa Parks in a way, just a woman, you know, could easily be overlooked, but someone with great strength and fortitude and did not take kindly to being ignored or labeled as the L word, you know, what they would call leper, which is a pejorative word for many people. She was tough, strong, tough, sweet, exasperating, all the things.
What was so tragic about the story was she was about to be married, right? She was going to start a new life.
Yeah.
And then a knock came on the door.
Right, right. You know, I didn't write this play until it was first performed in L.A. as a one act in 2015. So it had been, 9 years since she died. I did not write about her when I knew her because I was living it with her. And some people ask me, why didn't you write about it when she was around? Well, I was living it with her. Only later did it resonate that she was deserving of a play. And then we did the play the next year in 16 at Playbuilders of Hawaii at Kumukuhua. And then Manoa Valley contacted me and commissioned the full length. So it was some time between. And I don't know, she's a great subject. You know, her you see the strength of the older woman in the young woman. 18 years old, about to be married, everything comes crashing down. I don't know how any of us would handle that type of event. Many people would just fold. And she did suffer for it, but she found a strength in her that maybe she didn't know she had, you know.
Well, you know, I think this whole idea of isolation and exile, when we were going through the pandemic, just the range of emotions that came to the surface. And I remember doing interviews with some of the nuns there at Kalapapa when they were mm-hmm. trying to vaccinate the workers and the patients there. And just the trauma, reliving the trauma of that whole time as it was unfolding. It was re-traumatizing, I think.
Yeah, I think that the pandemic was tough on a lot of people, but they were used to being cut off, not only geographically, you know, Kalapapa was never an easy place to visit. They're just resuming some tours there, but it's as it should be, you know, and it's on the verge of great change, as you may know. Kalapapa is coming to the end of its life as a state-run facility, and it's still a national park, and it's Hawaiian homeland, so who knows what the future will be there, but there are very few patients left. When I met Olivia, there were about 150 or so. Now there's 3 or 4 living there. So, they're used to being isolated. But on top of that, there was the stigma of this disease, which goes back to, you know, there's a quote in the play from Leviticus, the Old Testament, about this. So we're talking about a thing that's much misunderstood, still much feared, and still very much in the world. Leprosy, Hansen's disease, as it's often called now, is not gone. It's still around.
Well, you know, I think just that pandemic experience and this story, right, it just resonates because people still have some of those emotions very close under the skin, and then thinking about what it was like so many decades ago with the first people that were sent there and exiled from their friends and family.
Yeah, some 8,000 plus people. They're working on a memorial there, similar to the Vietnam Memorial, where all the 8,000 names, including Olivia's and many others, would be inscribed. And it's that peninsula, Kalapapa's native Hawaiians that were there in the 1860s when King Kamehameha declared that's the place we're going to, under the advice of some Board of Health people, doctors and so on, that was the ideal place in their minds to send people. And so it disrupted the lives of the native people that were there. From what historians tell us, they did not flee. They were there and they helped as much as they could, but it did change their lives too. Some of them caught the disease as well. Father Damien is a whole nother chapter. When he came in the 1870s, that's when it really got on the map, the work he did there.
Yes, and we have Mother Mary Ann Cope, who also became a saint, and then Brother Dutton, I think, also there are efforts to recognize what he did down at the colony.
Yeah, these are all very deified people, not just because they're saints now, or Dutton soon to be, hopefully, but yeah, they all have a picture. You know, just like Latino Americans always had a picture of RFK, Cesar Chavez, and JFK in the house, right? Over there, it's Father Damien, Mother Mary Ann. And you know, Olivia, later on, in the late 60s, people were able to travel. The disease was under control. It wasn't cured, but it was controllable. It was not contagious. So they traveled, and Olivia went to Belgium, which is where Father Damien was from. And people in Kalapapa, they traveled like crazy because they couldn't for so long. They became real travel-holics.
What does it mean to you to know that her story will have a broader audience?
It's great. You know, we've been working on this for over a year. When I first spoke with Chuck Parker at PBS Hawaii, he was very interested, but he said, you know, you've got to clear the music and take care of some rights issues, which we did. We spent the last year doing that and remixed the film, and it was approved, and it'll be airing on May 21st at 8:30, and then again on Sunday the 24th at 12:30, and it'll be continuing. It'll be on their YouTube channel as well. But they've licensed it for 3 years, so they can show it as many times as they want. It's great. I think more people, hopefully, will see it in those first couple of days than saw it in the whole 6 weeks it was at Manoa Valley Theater, which is, I don't know how many plays have transferred to public television from there or anywhere, frankly, unless they're big Broadway type of things. The play is going to be done in Lisbon later this year. I licensed it to a Portuguese director and theater company, so it'll be done there as well. So that's going to be a bilingual production in Portuguese and English. So it has life, but I think this TV thing I'm very excited about. The cast all signed off on it, Manoa Valley Theater, everyone's got behind it. So we're excited to share her story, which is particularly relevant, I think, now.
Well, the fact that it will be on the public broadcast system and can be shared around the world is a terrific thing, a powerful story that deserves to be shared.
I agree. Thank you. That's true.
And that was Lorenzo Di Stefano, who wrote the play Shipment Day. The production will make its broadcast premiere on PBS Hawaii May 21st and 24th. Look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear about Jack Johnson's latest creative effort, the soundtrack to a documentary film about his life and causes. Have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Find the conversation as a podcast. Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.